Hi, everyone. I'm Lee Stabert, Editor-in-Chief of Keystone Edge. Welcome back to Season 2 of PRISM, a podcast series produced in partnership with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. We are so excited to continue shining a light on the power of creativity in PA communities. This new batch of apps will be coming out monthly, so don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. That way you'll never miss an episode. In this inaugural installment, we're heading west to Pittsburgh, where the Andy Warhol Museum is expanding its mission and its footprint. The treasured cultural institution is spearheading the Pop District, an initiative that encompasses everything from a live music venue and co-working spaces to workforce development programs and public art. To talk about the challenges and the incredible promise of this effort, we're joined by a representative from the museum and a local professional artist.
My name is Mikella Wunna, and I am a queer Nigerian-American multimedia artist and engineer, born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I currently serve as the president of Pittsburgh's Public Art and Civic Design Commission, and I am also the executive director of a Black LGBTQ art nonprofit, Rainbow Serpent, Inc.
My name is Dan Law. I'm the associate director of the Warhol. In that position, I oversee the Pop District, but also on the senior leadership and senior management team for the museum. So I oversee all aspects of the Pop District, its integration into the museum in itself, all of its components, including its strategic and fundraising capabilities.
Great. So Dan, first of all, can you give us the lay of the land for anyone listening to this, especially people who are not from Pittsburgh? Where is the Andy Warhol Museum? What neighborhood is it in? And what is the geographic relationship with this Pop District?
The Andy Warhol Museum is located on Pittsburgh's North Shore, and that's a pretty wide-reaching neighborhood. It extends all the way from effectively the confluence of the Monongahela, Allegheny, and Ohio rivers up the Allegheny corridor. It's a very specific space. It is a little bit separated, in some ways designed to be separated through civic design and other forms of redlining that occurred in the 20th century. But the North Shore is a pocket of space that exists between downtown Pittsburgh and the greater North Side neighborhoods. Those North Side neighborhoods are very, very diverse, historically unique, and at one point in our history were their own city, Allegheny City. So we're sort of in this, I wouldn't call it no man's land, but certainly in a place that has not been seen as connective, right? It's sort of a nether region, if you will. And sitting right in between that is the world's largest collection of the world's most valuable artists. So it's this extraordinary asset in an extremely under-leveraged area. I guess that's the best way of putting it. And that matters. That matters because one of the largest economies in the state of Pennsylvania is not connected with one of its most diverse and historic neighborhoods, but it's also not leveraging the maximum potential of our arts and entertainment offerings in the city of Pittsburgh, which, of course, I think on this podcast and beyond, we are arguing that the creative economy, the entertainment economy, the idea that artists should live and prosper in Pittsburgh, that would be the next 25 years of Pittsburgh's trajectory. Not exclusively relegated to, respectively, the areas of eds, meds, finance, research, biotech, and other really fantastic things that are happening in the city, technology, advanced technology, in particular AI systems. But yeah, a creative economy has to be up there on that sort of economic Mount Rushmore, if you will.
Yeah. And so, Mikhail, from your perspective, is Pittsburgh now a good place to be an artist? And what are the things that the city needs to kind of take it to the next level, both from a global and national reputation as a place for arts, but also just a day-to-day life for someone who hopes to make their living as a creative person?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I think, as Dan said, just to echo him, it's a big question around what Pittsburgh's future and direction looks like over the next 25 years in particular. I see that there are a lot of opportunities for artists here in Pittsburgh. And I think so there's a few different dimensions of that. First, we have world-class institutions like the Andy Warhol Museum. They also have a strong philanthropic community that also does support and provide grants and opportunities for individual artists. And historically, even though this is shifting, Pittsburgh has had a lower cost of living, which has made things like studio space or just cost of living in general for artists more accessible. Although, again, that is something that has been changing, particularly over the last few years. There are also, though, a lot of headwinds that artists face in the city. Specifically, Black artists in the city face a lot of headwinds. I think first is, and that's really around the dimensions around the life of an artist. You know, it's not just, you know, also to the creative opportunities, but also what does it mean to actually live in the city? And so the quality of life for Black people in the city has been ranked historically quite low. For example, just the other year, Pittsburgh was ranked as the worst city in the country for Black women and among the worst for Black men. And so this is across dimensions like healthcare, economic disparities, access to housing, etc. And even just in the 2010s alone, Pittsburgh lost 7,000 people from its Black population. So even as the population for Pittsburgh in from other demographics was increasing, Black people were migrating out of the city. And so it really does show that there are a lot of missing links there. And I think specifically for how that affects Black artists is, you know, there are a lot of missing pipelines. You know, how do we build marketable skills, job and artistic opportunities for ourselves as we advance in our careers? And so, you know, I think the Pop District is filling the gap, you know, in many capacities. For example, with the Warhol Academy, the Workforce Development Program there is building a pipeline of talent here in the city, providing people with marketable skills and opportunities. That's something that did not exist in the same way before. And also the Pop District is, you know, with the programs and installations, that does provide opportunities for local artists to advance in their careers. And so, you know, I think we are poised. I think there's a lot of opportunities in Pittsburgh. There are a lot of headwinds. And I think the Pop District is part of that solution for how we're thinking about, you know, taking that next step over the next 25 years.
Yeah, I think we've jumped ahead a little bit. What is the Pop District?
Sure.
You know, I we're talking about Warhol as an institution and then also this trying to expand the footprint. So Dan, can you help us out a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. The Pop District, it is in effect what happens when you turn the Andy Warhol Museum inside out. It's a physical and programmatic expansion of the museum. And really it's constituted in three ways. It sort of exists in three ways. One is creative economy workforce program that's specifically focused on young people. And we have a pretty broad definition of what we term young, right? Youth. We're talking about teenagers all the way up into early to mid-career even. The second piece is a public art initiative, in particular, focusing on incredible artists like Mikkel. And the third is a campus expansion where we're going to actually physically develop the neighborhood, which will be anchored by a flagship live music and live event venue that is going to help the museum bring in much, much needed earned income, and which we can talk about here a little bit later, but focusing on the business of art, right, which is a very Warholian concept, but the economics of art, the economics of an art museum and what an art museum has to be in the 21st century, you can't ignore the financial component of it. So the Pop District not only executes on these three levels, but it actually drives at, you know, a kind of core sustainability principle for the museum itself. And it helps us chart that next 25 years with more financial sustainability in mind.
Mikkel, there's something kind of thorny here as I'm hearing this talk, which is this is an institution, the Warhol Museum. I think they're saying the right things in terms of wanting to be inclusive. They're trying to really build this out in a way that includes people, includes different voices. But there's an inherent thing that happens if this thing is really successful, that it could spur gentrification, it could spur development, it could spur bigger changes that have traditionally not always been so great for marginalized communities, for the Black community. How do you work with an organization like this and, you know, keep them honest and try to make sure that you can do the best job possible of having this thing thrive, but making sure the benefits rebound to everyone?
Yeah. And I think that's one of the, that's a great question. And I think one of the pieces that is helping in that capacity is the workforce development component of the work. I think with that, you are able to still be building skills, long-term skills for artists and creatives in the city, particularly ones who are marginalized and will face the largest impact from gentrification, displacement from large increasing costs of living, et cetera, in their neighborhoods. And so I think one of the things is that, you know, how are people actually able to still have a life for themselves in the city? How are they able to have job opportunities and creative opportunities as well? And so that component does help. You know, it's not a silver bullet at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I think these are long-term structural issues and challenges that we face as a city, as a region, as a nation. And so the workforce development is one component. You know, I think we also need to think, though, like holistically about how this is a larger creative ecosystem. So how are these challenges being thought of at the city level, at the state level, because it's not just, you know, one institution maybe has a few spots that they're able to give people skills and, you know, provide job opportunities. It needs to really be a citywide effort, particularly because it's not just the creative economy that's growing in Pittsburgh. As Dan mentioned, it is also the education sector, biomedical, technology. So all of these things in tandem are, you know, changing the face of the city. And so it does require a structural effort and a lot of intentionality around how we are also providing opportunities for people who have historically been in these communities and been in the city.
Yeah. So Dan, can you talk a little bit about the workforce programs? And has that been something that Warhol has been committed to for a while? How are you able to use the POP District to expand that programming?
Absolutely. I'd like to actually expand on what Mikhail was talking about, because it's really important. We talk about gentrification, displacement, and particularly access to opportunities for marginalized communities. We've traveled around North America looking at models to try to learn, right? See what people were doing right, what people were doing wrong. And so much that I've learned in my career about gentrification, I used to work in startups and economic development in an East End neighborhood of Pittsburgh, which was rife with gentrification issues. It's called East Liberty. Ownership is always a critical piece to the puzzle. If one does not, whether it's an individual, an organization, or a group that does not own their assets, right, does not have physical ownership in the system in which the economic system in which we live, you're going to be vulnerable. Right. And so the Warhol has a very specific strategy, which is, can the museum itself take up as much space as possible? And then can it turn that space into valuable, trusted space for marginalized communities? Right. So it's one thing just to buy up space and build an apartment condo or apartment complex or whatever. Or do you turn it into a public art park? And can you use that to advance the careers of people? Right? Can you use that to advance the lives of people? And these are never perfect scenarios, right? They're always a little bit of a give and take situation. And back to that original question about geography, you know, we are sitting in this sort of office park, right? With not a dense residential component. But my estimation or my guess is that will change. That'll very much change, especially as you see continued development with the POP District, continued growth. You know, people are going to start asking questions, developers are going to move in. It's how do you strike that balance? It's an open question. And I wouldn't even pretend to know that or pretend to suggest that we're the experts, right? Or that we're going to solve it. There's a silver bullet, to Mikhail's point. But the workforce platform is our attempt at creating a form of access, right? A form of inclusion, a form of equity that offers people an on-ramp into this economy. So it can be an uncomfortable conversation talking about economics and finances. It has a way of distilling people into numbers and being very reductive about human beings. But at the end of the day, the needs assessments and the surveys and the community feedback forums we get, particularly from our immediate neighborhoods on the north side, is that families want family-sustaining wages and things for their kids to do after school, mm-hmm. right? They're not necessarily asking for more art on the walls, right? It's not that they don't like it, they don't appreciate it, but, you know, if a family of four from the north side that, say, is living under $75,000 a year, can they afford multiple trips to a museum where an average ticket price is $22, right? Sure, if they get a membership, and that's always available through our museum system, but that type of accessibility is really tough if you don't have the economic potential. And we're particularly focused on young people and our ability to equip with those skills and then focus on not just the on-ramp and the participation experience, but the off-ramp, right? The connection to the jobs, connections to the opportunities, the education, the learning. That builds and reinforces itself over time. You know, it's not going to happen in just, you know, 2 seconds or 6 months or a year. This is a decade long, if not decades long, type of transformation. Because if we consider the quote unquote renaissance that Pittsburgh has experienced, I think, I don't know, Mikkel, how many times have you heard this word? Like, we've been on, we're on number four.
About that.
Yeah. They talk about these in terms of generations. So it's a question of how much are we willing to commit to a generation of transformation? And then how do we use platforms, brands, names, and the power really of museums and arts and cultural organizations to promote people like Mikkel? I mean, he is in some ways just the sort of quintessential archetype of the type of person who should succeed and thrive in Pittsburgh. An artist, an engineer, a scientist, an innovator. You know, those are Warholian characteristics that should be able to fit right in the Pittsburgh ecosystem and thrive.
Yeah.
And if that's not happening, then we need to ask ourselves really honest questions about why.
And Mikkel, so what needs to happen in Pittsburgh where, you know, a young Black artist from a small town in Southwest Pennsylvania or from Erie or wherever, where they don't say, I'm going to New York, they say, I'm going to Pittsburgh. Like, this is the place to be. Well, what are the things that you can do, that your organization can do, that the city can do to get there?
Yeah, I think that I would first say that there is a really long and storied history in Pittsburgh, particularly of Black artists. You know, I think when we look at the Harlem Renaissance, there was, you know, Harlem, and then there was the Hill District. And you have such an amazing legacy, particularly of African-American artists who have really transformed the face of not only Pittsburgh, but, you know, regional and national culture as well. This includes figures like August Wilson, Romare Bearden, Lena Horne, Billy Strayhorn. I mean, there's so many figures that have emerged from Pittsburgh. And so that legacy is there. I think it's about how is that investment and how are those artists valued while they're here so that they're able to actually build a career in Pittsburgh. And so I think there are a few elements of that. I think the first is really strategic investment and support for Black artists in the city, you know, to help overcome that long-term legacy of being systematically excluded from opportunities in the creative economy, as Dan has mentioned. And so I think this includes, you know, strategic investment in grants for Black artists, affordable studio space, opportunities to showcase artwork here. And there has been work done, particularly with the Advancing Black Arts in Pittsburgh grant. But I think, how do we actually scale those up, make more opportunities for artists here, scale up the scale of them, the grants as well, so that it's not that you have a grant to help produce work, but then you still have like 4 part-time jobs, you know, you're able to actually sustain a career as an artist in the city. I think it also, there's an education component. You know, how are we also strengthening the arts education in the city, particularly, you know, at the elementary, middle, high school level, and also for institutions of higher learning? And also, I think public art initiatives are also a really important part of that too. Because with public art, people not only have an opportunity to build a larger audience for their work, but public art also comes with larger budgets. You work with larger teams. You get plugged into a larger ecosystem and economy that way. Thinking about Pittsburgh as a place where people, it's like a destination where people come and younger Black artists see like, oh, wow, there's all of this Black art that's in the city. You know, you can have these opportunities. You can showcase your work at the Warhol and these public art sites around the city. And so you know that there's opportunities that you can actually take advantage of there. And so I feel like, you know, these are all important parts of actually building the infrastructure for a Black artist to be able to make a career here. And I think as we think long term as well, one of the challenges is that, you know, some people might be able to first start by, you know, finding some opportunities to help them start as an emerging artist. But then as they grow their careers, they then are not able to then find additional opportunities as they move into a mid-career or an advanced stage of their career. And so it does require also a strategic effort by the larger institutions in the city. And this is why, you know, the work of the POP district is really important too, to also be able to provide opportunities for artists who are entering into like from trying to transition from emerging to mid-career and also still be able to stay in Pittsburgh. Some people might come here for the early part of their career because they were here for school, or maybe they had some exhibitions or they got a grant. But then if they're like, okay, if I want to grow my career to the next level, I have to move to New York. I have to move to LA. I have to move to Atlanta. And so I think that's been, I mean, that's a conversation that Dan and I have also had too, about if there was, you know, quote unquote, the next Andy Warhol, how would he not have to actually move to New York to actually have a career?
Yeah. I mean, the expression we use is, you know, we built this workforce program so that the next Andy Warhol does not have to leave Pittsburgh to become Andy Warhol. You know, Andy, when he left in the late 1940s, it wasn't like he was alone in that, I guess, exodus, right? Dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of creatives left Pittsburgh, particularly from Carnegie Tech. And it's actually a remarkable amount of Carnegie Tech trained, or I guess in this instance, Carnegie Mellon University trained artists ended up in New York City, right? And so Andy was one of many, many, many. And I mean, he did happen to become Andy Warhol eventually, but he did spend an entire decade cultivating that. And he made his living as a commercial illustrator. Right. And so that's a kind of a well-known part of his biography at this point, but not always. Right. I think that there are people who may still think that he just sort of walked in and started, you know, whipping up Campbell's soup cans or something and became super famous. But the fact of the matter is he struggled in many ways, and he struggled as an artist, particularly a queer artist in the 1950s when that was not accepted, period. Right. And so he was not particularly well received critically. He had a very difficult time making it into gallery shows. He had a very difficult time making it into the established art sort of art scene or the network in New York. All of these things can be experienced in Pittsburgh as an artist. Yeah. Right. Having trouble tapping into the network, having trouble tapping into the sort of scene, if you will, having a patron class, having a gallery ecosystem that can patch you into the more traditional business opportunities and business verticals of the art world. All of those are very nascent here. And Mikhail just talked about that quite a bit, but it bears repeating that 360 degree professional apparatus has to exist around artists. Mm-hmm. And museums and arts and cultural organizations are just one component of that. You know, a patron class that is accustomed and experienced in supporting artists, in buying art, that has to develop here in Pittsburgh. We have to have sophisticated galleries with not just local networks, but regional, national, and international networks. Those have to ground themselves and root themselves here. In many ways, we still look to places like New York as effectively the center of that universe. But there's not a particularly compelling reason, at least to me, and I think Mikhail would agree with me, that Pittsburgh cannot take a bite of that apple. And with a little bit more intention.
You're listening to Prism on Keystone Edge in partnership with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, which believes that building stronger communities takes creativity. Learn more about how the council supports Pennsylvania's diverse creative sector at arts.pa.gov.
I think we all know, especially in our contemporary world, how much value artists add to cities. And so much of it is like that cool factor. You know, people want to be places that feel creative, that feel like somewhere an artist would want to be. And I just keep thinking about Andy Warhol and this guy who was like the epitome of cool, but you were saying, you know, worked as a commercial artist. And then also clearly was obsessed with the intersection of commercial and art. And what comes out of that. So, you know, when you grow up enough, Andy Warhol, you know, long gone, but like you grow up enough, you become the institution. I mean, he's now the institution, this guy who was pushing boundaries, you know, at the foreground. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch in some ways like an artist who was a renegade, a revolutionary pioneer, become the quote unquote establishment. But, you know, that's just life, right? You
If you're lucky, if anyone remembers
you. If you're lucky,
you.
Right. I mean, you eventually become so powerful and so far reaching. And again, okay, that's fine. The Warhol Museum is not a tribute. Our mission is to dedicate ourselves to the life, art, and legacy of Andy Warhol, the good, the bad, and the in-between. And, you know, Warhol's legacy just has just as much to do with his creative pioneering as how he built this empire, which some would say, you know, there's ruthless elements to that. There's even manipulative elements to that. And some would say impersonalness to it, very cold, very transactional in some ways. And that's, you know, that's a broader TED talk about, you know, and there's, you know, how many PhDs and books written about all of that kind of stuff. But the point I think that we're really driving at is, what does an artist have to be in the 21st century to be successful? What does that artist need to have to be successful? And beyond just quote unquote artist, you know, what does a creator or a creative person need to be successful? And I would say we could still challenge our city with a pretty straightforward question, which is, can a young person, in particular a young person of color, or a young LGBTQ plus person, or a young immigrant person, walk throughout our city and say, can I make a living here through my creative power, through my creative intellect, through a knowledge and information economy? And you might get a lot of yeses, but I think you still get a lot of no's.
So then what's the future? If we look at the Pop District as a tool to accomplish this goal of making Pittsburgh a sustainable place to be a working artist, what does that success look like? Is the Pop District itself a household name, or is it more about just sort of an influence campaign and changing the culture, or is it both?
It's both. Yeah. It really is both. We don't hesitate to talk about that. This is a bit of a Trojan horse strategy, right? The Pop District should, of course, be a household name. It should be really multiple things. It should be a physical place. It should be seen as a strategy for how arts and culture organizations behave and interact in the 21st century. But it should also be a revolution in some respects about how arts and cultural organizations can break certain systems that are not serving the populations that need to be serving. So it will be an identifiable place. It'll be a place where 100,000 people who wouldn't otherwise come to Pittsburgh's North Shore will show up because they will have multiple art experiences. Like I said before, you know, we're not asking for more art on the wall as a community. People still want to come to museums. You know, in August of this year, we set our attendance record all time, 30 years, all time high. Because our regional asset district, we call it RAD, underwrote admission. So the demand to go see art is there. It's the barriers to entry. So in the next 10 years, those barriers are going to have to drop, right? So the museum has to offer multiple points of access. So public art is a critical component to that. It's free. It's free. Just walk right up to it. I see people dancing in front of Mikkel's mural. You know, it's beautiful at night because it has this extraordinary kind of warmth and temperature lighting against it. It becomes this backdrop to people's lived experiences. Then people decide, hey, I want to go see a concert, or I'm going to go to a wedding or a party, and I'm going to take that Instagram photo that's going to make me, you know, cool with all of my friends. All of those things don't really have to do with walking into the galleries of an art museum. But let's say we catch 10% of that 100,000 number that all go into the galleries and they start to explore. And then we factor in a new curatorial vision, a new curatorial program that explicitly focuses on underrepresented artists, right? And giving those artists shows inside the museum. The force multiplier effect of that goes way through the roof. Right. And so no longer is the Eastern North Shore a one-stop shop where you show up, you look at some Warhol art and you leave. You actually can spend an entire day in the Pop District and have a multidimensional experience. That's what success looks like on a very practical level.
Yeah, I would just add that I think that, you know, the Pop District is also helping to redefine the understanding of what a museum is and how it can live within a community. I would say, you know, there was this really interesting study that I read. It was from 2010 by Reach Advisors, I believe, but that can be double checked. And it showed that at the time, it was that 92% of the audience for museums were white. And so, and only I think 2% were Black. And so that's not necessarily representative of the actual demographics of this country. And I think a lot of it is that people don't feel like they necessarily feel represented within museums. They don't feel welcome within gallery spaces. And so how do institutions open up spaces to make, you know, for example, through public art initiatives, which can be a magnet that people, you know, who maybe historically felt that they were not allowed to come into these spaces or were historically excluded from these spaces, see a representation of themselves that reflects themselves, they engage with the public artwork. It's something that then brings them in and makes them, it brings them into the community of the district. And then people then start coming in, they get drawn in by the public art. Then they're like, oh, well, my son or daughter is really talented in as a social media creator or a videographer. You know, they're looking for opportunities. Oh, there's this workforce program where they can learn, develop their skills, find opportunities. And so it starts bringing people in who historically have been excluded in a way. And I think that's what my hope is, really, you know, with this mixture of public art, workforce development, and this other programmatic elements that are being brought into this space, that it creates an exciting model to redefine how museums can live within a community and how they can also engage a wider segment of the population and also bring in more opportunities, not just for, you know, the most famous international artists who are all around, but, you know, people who are also locally embedded in the community and can also provide a, sometimes it's like, really, you can see a model for, okay, you know, that's possible for me too. And that you can build a career in the city and find opportunities as well. So I think that's what my hope is, really, yeah, for how the Pop District can also then serve as that model for other institutions in the city of Pittsburgh.
It's really well put, and I want to maybe just tie on a little bit there. That there's a principle about you can't be what you can't see. We say that a lot with our workforce program. But having, for example, this summer when Mikkel cut the ribbon, and you know there was all this media, and he was on TV, and you know, so this is an extraordinary thing. Okay, now we have a young, vibrant, queer-identifying Black artist, right, who is here, and people see that, they appreciate that, and they can be that, because now he broke through. Like Mikkel just broke through and made that a reality. And that's extremely important. And on a daily level, if you come up to, you know, we have a 9,300 square foot workforce space that has production studios, classrooms, co-working, you'll see young people of color working on TikToks, Instagrams, mini documentaries. They have headphones on just like me right here, but they're staring at computer screens and they're working on Adobe and all these other editing platforms, Pro Tools, all of these things. And if one can't see that, it's very hard to imagine one sort of participating in it, but it has to be present and constant. And I think that consistency piece is just kind of, I basically am repeating what Mikkel just said, so I apologize, but that has to be there all the time. It can't just show up for a little bit, then go away, right? Because if it's the consistency builds trust, and that trust builds sustainability.
And what are the plans for the built environment? Because it is interesting looking at a map that this is a space that is has a lot of barriers in terms of the highways, et cetera, that make it not as accessible as I'm sure as you would like to be. Are there any long-term plans in terms of the actual physical space of the neighborhood to make it a little bit more welcoming, enable people to come from the north, from the other sides, as opposed to just across the river?
Absolutely. And there's a really interesting statistic that I think we should lead with here, which is about 60 to 70% of attendees at the Andy Warhol Museum are coming from out of town. So the opportunity here is local. And we talk about this geographic corridor. It's really it's an intersection. It's the intersection of Sandusky and General Robinson. And over the years, we have trained our market, we have trained our communities to treat this intersection as effectively a throughway, right? It is a place you just have to drop by or get through to get where you're going. Public art is an extraordinary intervention in that sense of creating place. I would certainly argue that Mikhail's recent piece is transformative and almost superlative in that effect. But when we talk about the changing of this whole space, it's going to have to intersect with a lot of different initiatives, a lot of different organizations who are doing complementary work. We have to work collaboratively. And I know we use the word collaborative all the time, but River Life, right? An extraordinary organization. They have an initiative called Closing the Loop. They're focused on the riverfront community and the Three Sister Bridges. That's two blocks from the museum. And that experience connects us with downtown. Kendra, who is the new CEO of the Cultural Trust, who's fabulous, and you should probably be on this show, she talks about these value adds and how the Pop District is effectively an expansion of the cultural district itself. It's in dialogue, but it's also in close. They're basically related to one another, as opposed to being seen as a competition. And that is a culture change that geography can help bridge. Instead of treating all of this stuff as competitive or sort of defined by scarcity, this is all seen as a force multiplier. It's all seen as a contributory or additive. And it takes leadership from individuals outside the Warhol. It takes leadership from the city to sort of see and bridge all those connections together. So, you know, at the end of the day, the Pop District becomes tightly integrated with the North Side, the Cultural District, downtown, the stadiums, and it's this one big cohesive unit where an audience or a person would go and say, well, they would not maybe draw a distinction between going and seeing a baseball game and then taking a picture in front of public art and then going seeing and experiencing a museum all in one day. They would see that as one big thing. And I think that it yields an enormous amount of potential.
Mikhail, anything you want to say about Pittsburgh's, about the built environment or in the Pop District? And, you know, as I've been to Pittsburgh, I actually haven't been in a long time and I love Pittsburgh. I would love to go back again soon. The rivers are such just an integral part of everything. There are also barriers and then there are highways. There's all these different things that can both be connectors, but they can also be walls. And how do you make sure that you're open to neighborhoods when people might have to cross, let's say, like, or go, do they go under the highway? How can you even walk into this, into the space from the north? I don't know. Tell me.
Yeah. You would go underneath the highway.
Underneath the highway. Like, are there efforts like with lighting and public art to make that feel accessible and safe?
Well, I think Dan can talk about kind of the future of some of the additional activations that are coming for the area. I would say that one of the really big opportunities that's coming from the built environment for the Pop District is also the proximity that we have to a lot of the stadiums. So there's like the PNC Park is literally right down the street. Acrisure
Stadium. I'm going to have to say it. Yes.
Excuse me?
Yes. Bless you.
I had to pause for a second. Acrisure Stadium, the new name for the home for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
I mean, that doesn't really roll off the tongue.
We're definitely not. We're not like a really good ad for Acrisure right now.
No, I know. So I'm like, yes. Anyway, so I think a lot of people from across the southwestern Pennsylvania region and beyond converge on Pittsburgh, and specifically those two sites for the games. And it's like huge. I mean, every game. I mean, the Steelers games can have like 56,000 people there. The Pirates games also have kind of really large attendance. And so one of the pieces, sometimes when I've been to a game, I'm like, I wonder how many people have actually been to one of the cultural institutions that we have, because people from across the region are all coming together for this moment. But then it's like, oh, then they disappear and we never see them again. And so I think one of the things that's really exciting is that when people are leaving a Pirates game now, you know, they're driving down and the one way you go, people used to just zip past the Warhol. And maybe if they are part of the arts community here, not even realize that it's happening there. And I think it's been really amazing for me to see since the piece that I did with the Pop District went up, now people are like stopping there. They're coming from the games. They're taking pictures. They're dancing. And so I think it's already becoming a source of connection between this huge community that really cuts across all the demographics in the southwestern Pennsylvania region and globally. And then how do we then bring these people into the arts community and arts, and which can kind of live on its own in many respects too. So it's exciting to see the public art that's part of the Pop District. And, you know, that's kind of starting with kind of this activation that I had an amazing opportunity to do, now serving as a bridge between these multiple communities that hopefully again can also be another generator for how Pittsburgh is this creative hub. Because now people in the community who are coming from all across the region are now seeing the amazing artwork and the amazing work that's being done by institutions like the Andy Warhol Museum.
Yeah, and it's a really good point. I mean, there's just so much. In fact, I believe statistically, this is the highest pedestrian trafficked area in the region, right? There's just so much foot traffic happening for the very reasons that Mikhail just talked about. But the connection that you brought up between us and the north side is really important. There's an overpass, it's 279, and then there's a railroad line, and there's railroad tunnels. So there's railroad tunnels, and then there's overpasses, interstate overpasses. And underneath it, it's dark. Underneath it, it's mostly parking lots and poorly lit interstitial space. And yes, new lighting is super helpful, not just from a sort of directional sense of like where I am, but, you know, for public safety, multimodal transportation and all that kind of stuff. Public art, I think we've talked about this at length, but deploying public art in those spaces will have a transformative effect. But, comma, there's an extraordinary amount of an uphill climb, I guess. There's a huge uphill climb in making these spaces or transforming these spaces. Because, listen, if it was just up to us, you know, we'd go out there and start painting facades. It's not necessarily that hard. The ownership components of these spaces are very complex. So one is that you have a railroad that's owned by Norfolk Southern. They own the bricks. They own the rail line. They make all decisions based on what you want to do with that. You have to ask permission. And it's completely incumbent upon them to either say yes or no, or maybe, or never just ignore you, right? You have the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. You have a federal interstate system. You have the county. You have the city. That's just a handful of folks. And that doesn't include, you know, the operators, the folks who are subleasing some of these properties and other things like that, who all factor in to this transformation piece. But that's the deal. Like, that's the job when it comes to these creative placemaking efforts. It's really unglamorous. And it takes a long time. And a lot of artists will tell you that, too, that particularly those who work in the public art space, that transformation takes years sometimes. I mean, in fact, just to get Mikhail's piece up, we had to build a unique scaffolding structure just to make sure the engineering was right to ensure that it could even stand up and not, you know, it could withstand certain wind speeds. So there are a lot of science to this. There's a lot of administration, there's a lot of logistics to this. And I think the optimistic spin on that is, hey, you don't have to just be an artist to work in the creative economy. What if you like building stuff? Like, what if you like being a program manager, a project manager? What if you like detail-oriented work and working with intergovernmental relations and things like that? That's all part of the creative economy, and it adds to the experience. So it's not all, you know, I paint maybe a picture that talks about kind of frustration and time and, you know, attrition, but it's also an opportunity for really bright people to get on the ground floor, not just artists, but people who bring other skills to the table.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about access and inclusion. I would be remiss if I just didn't end with saying, this is actually how you get involved with us. This is go to the popdistrict.org and learn more about what's on that website, and then click and put your information in, because that goes directly to us. And here's how, if you're listening to this or you're curious or you know somebody who would want to involve, every opportunity with the Pop District and our workforce is paid or fully subsidized. So if you are a fellow in content creation or filmmaking or post-production, it's a $3,000 stipend. If you want to be a part of the digital marketing diploma program that we offer through the Carnegie Institute, that's fully subsidized. If you're a high schooler and you want to get involved with our learning and public engagement team, those have stipends. So everybody that comes through our doors is compensated for their time in one way, shape, or form. And if one can really stay in our network, whether it's through fellowship or diploma experiences or high school experiences, we do hire. We have two things. We have the Warhol Academy and we have the Warhol Creative. The Academy is that portfolio of programs, those learning programs that you can build, those that skills, knowledge, and disposition. And then we have a boutique content creation studio. So if you go on to Warhol TikTok or our Warhol Instagram, you will see young voices, particularly diverse voices, telling the story of the museum, which is a pretty much a departure from how museums have traditionally done things. But those pieces of content are built, developed, and produced by young people themselves, and they're compensated to do it. So we are looking at recruiting more and more people who want to do just that. And then those young people should be able to transfer this experience and leverage this experience to whatever professional endeavor they want to take after it.
That's it for this episode of PRISM. We're so happy to be back. If you have any thoughts on the conversation you just heard or ideas for what we should cover in upcoming episodes, please visit our website, keystoneedge.com, and reach out. You can also message us on Facebook or Instagram. Until next time.